by 5 p.m. Blustery northwest winds. Our evening lows tomorrow down near 30 below. For Friday, our high temperatures near 12 below zero.
We're going to see snow and ice dipping way down into the south. We're talking down into areas of Oklahoma, Texas, over to the southeast.
A large part of the U.S. is expected to be in the grips of a huge winter storm this weekend.
For Wednesday, January 21st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. During his speech in Davos, President Trump said he's ruling out for now using military force to acquire Greenland.
People thought I would use force, but I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force.
Also, what is the impact of polyester clothes on your health and the environment?
Once you know better, it's like your eyes are opened up to the fact that there are just so many poorly made clothes out there.
And a new study is out with some good news about heart disease.
That's right. Deaths caused by strokes and other heart conditions are dropping.
Those stories and more coming up after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump has canceled his threat to impose more tariffs on Europe, saying he has come to an agreement with NATO General Secretary Mark Rutte over a framework of a future deal on Greenland. He now says the U.S. will not use military force to take the Arctic island, but he's still making threats.
So we want a piece of ice for world protection, and they won't give it. We've never asked for anything else, and we could have kept that piece of land, and we didn't. So they have a choice. You can say yes, and we will be very appreciative, or you can say no, and we will remember.
Trump's comments have sparked concerns about a potential geopolitical standoff. NATO ally Denmark remains firm on its sovereignty over Greenland. California Governor Gavin Newsom says a media event he had planned at the World Economic Forum was canceled under pressure from the Trump administration. From member station KQED, Guy Marzorati has more.
Newsom was scheduled to speak at USA House, the official U.S. pavilion at the Global Summit, and deliver a critique of Trump's economic management. But the governor's office says the invitation was canceled under pressure by the White House and State Department. The Trump administration did not respond directly to a question about Newsom's claim, but a White House spokesperson accused the governor of, quote, frolicking around Switzerland instead of fixing the many problems he created in California. Newsom has spent part of this week lambasting Trump policies and calling out European leaders. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati in San Jose.
The Supreme Court heard arguments today over the president's power to fire a member of the Federal Reserve's governing board. NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Trump has been waging a pressure campaign for the central bank to lower interest rates.
The Trump administration says the president was within his rights to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook over allegations she made false statements on mortgage applications, even though Cook denies any wrongdoing. During oral arguments, Cook's lawyer Paul Clement said when it comes to the central bank, lawmakers deliberately put limits on the president's firing power to insulate the Fed from political pressure.
Congress, political animals, one and all, knew better than anyone that the short-term temptations to lower interest rates and have easy money was a disaster in the long term, but was going to be irresistible.
Trump has insisted interest rates should be much lower, but Cook and other Fed policymakers are expected to hold rates steady when they meet next week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Meteorologists warn that a polar vortex could bring severe winter weather to much of the United States. Warm Arctic waters and cold continental land are combining to send sub-zero temperatures, heavy snow, and ice across the eastern two-thirds of the country. The Midwest and north could see temperatures as low as 30 degrees below zero. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. House Republicans are pushing to hold former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in contempt of Congress over the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. It could lead to a criminal prosecution and send the Clintons to prison. Republican House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer says the Clintons have responded to the subpoena with defiance. The Clintons argue the subpoena is invalid. South Carolina officials say they expect the fast-growing measles outbreak to last for several more weeks, if not months, unless more people get vaccinated against the virus. As NPR's Maria Godoy reports, the state has confirmed 646 measles cases so far.
More than 530 people are currently in quarantine in South Carolina after being exposed to measles. That includes more than 80 students at Clemson and Anderson universities. The vast majority of cases so far have been in kids and teens who are unvaccinated. State epidemiologist Linda Bell says 10 people, both children and adults, have been hospitalized.
The current trajectory where we are seeing double-digit cases that are newly identified each day is very concerning.
South Carolina health officials are urging people who are unvaccinated to get two doses of the measles vaccine. Bell says that uptake of the vaccine remains lower than officials would like to see to stem the outbreak. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Love letters spanning five centuries are on display at Britain's National Archives in London. It opens Saturday and runs into April. The documents include legendary romances from British history, featuring royalty, soldiers, songsmiths, and spies. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It's 5:06. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Adolescent Crisis Response Team. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211, lending support to residents under the age of 18, as well as parental supports when in crisis or experiencing family distress 24/7. Our lows tonight, 14 to 19 below zero. Partly sunny tomorrow, temperatures falling throughout the day with blustery northwest winds. Lows tomorrow night near 30 below.
All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A massive winter storm is forecast to hit a large part of the U.S. this weekend, stretching more than 2,000 miles from the southwest into the northeast. A blast of cold air from Canada is expected to bring single-digit temperatures to much of the south, along with substantial accumulations of snow and ice. From Texas to the Carolinas, people are deferring travel and getting ready for possible power outages. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
In Georgia, the winter storm is expected to bring snow and ice. Governor Brian Kemp says plans to respond to the storm began days ago.
We're already looking at next weekend. We'll be prepared, treating roads, having teams ready. Hopefully we get snow and not ice.
The winter storm will develop over the southwest on Friday and begin moving east. Frigid temperatures and significant accumulations of snow and ice are possible throughout the southeastern U.S. on Saturday. By Sunday, forecasts show the system moving into the northeast and dropping as much as a foot of snow in some places. Jason Furtado is an associate professor of meteorology at the University of Oklahoma.
We're going to see snow and ice dipping way down into the south. We're talking down into, areas of Oklahoma, Texas, over to, the southeast, even parts of, Georgia into the Piedmont. But also it's the tremendous cold coming in behind it.
Southern states may see days of single-digit temperatures with wind chills as low as 10 degrees below zero. Winter storm watches have been issued for parts of several states, including Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Tennessee. Charles Dalton with the National Weather Service in Morristown, Tennessee, says throughout the region, the big concern is ice.
That starts to bring in the possibility of power outages, downed trees, really, really hazardous travel. You can drive in snow to a degree, but you start talking about freezing rain and sleet and stuff, and that gets, it gets much more tricky.
In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott activated emergency response resources and warned residents to prepare for snow, ice, and freezing rain. For many Texans, the prospect of a winter storm followed by days of freezing temperatures raises memories of 2021, when millions lost power for days. Allison Prater with the National Weather Service in Fort Worth says freezing temperatures from this storm won't last as long or be as low as they were in 2021.
In 2021, the minimum temperature was -2, while as of right now in our forecast, the minimum temperature is only going to be around more like 9 to 10.
ERCOT, the group that operates the Texas power grid, has issued an extreme cold weather advisory, but says with upgrades it's made after 2021, it anticipates it has enough power to meet demands. Ed Herz, an energy expert at the University of Houston, says while the Texas grid is more resilient than it was 5 years ago, the cold snap could freeze wind turbines or have other impacts that disrupt power generation.
That can cascade across ERCOT because it's such a vast geographic area. It's really difficult for ERCOT to isolate nodes that are having problems. So a problem in Austin, could lead to a failure in Dallas or in Houston.
Even in areas that don't see much precipitation, there will be low temperatures, below zero into Monday for more than 100 million Americans. Greg Allen, NPR News.
All this week, we've been traveling through the sprawling metropolises of West Africa. And today, we're in Togo, a narrow sliver of a country squeezed between Benin and Ghana. Here, a group of iconic businesswomen known as the Nana Bens are celebrated as national treasures. Their legacy still inspires others today. They built huge fortunes in the fabric trade, and that name came from the Mercedes Benzes they drove. But while textiles remain a major industry, that kind of success now feels out of reach. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu has the story.
Bundles of colorful fabrics fill dozens of boutiques at the sprawling Grand Marché, the largest market in Togo's capital, Lomé. Dyed indigo prints from Nigeria and glossy fabrics from Mali and Senegal line the walls. But it's the Dutch wax fabrics dense with swirling floral designs that are at the heart of the fairy tale rise of the Nana Bens. Songs like this one by Togolese singer King Mensa have immortalized the Nana Bens, glamorous women dressed in immaculate fabrics who would ride their luxury cars down the palm-lined streets of Lomé. The Nana Bens were working-class fabric traders who shot to fame in the 1950s by importing wax fabrics, which exploded in popularity, widely produced by Dutch company Vlisco. It propelled the women who dominated the market into new wealth and turned them into symbols of the region's commercial potential. Dozens of Vlisco boutiques still populate the Grand Marché, selling textiles and memorializing the traders who founded them. So we've just arrived at a pretty spellbinding Vlisco store at the Grand Marché in Lomé. Downstairs, it's like any of the others, full of beautiful fabrics lining the walls and on shelves across the store. But then you climb upstairs and it's an incredible exhibition. The walls are covered in archival pictures, framed pictures of four generations of women who belong to the Nana Bens, posing in front of Mercedes-Benz and other cars. One of the boutiques is run by 62-year-old Francesca Ayayi, who now runs it with her daughter. Ayayi inherited the business from her 92-year-old mother, among a few of the original group of Nana Bens who are still alive today. Speaking in a blend of the local language Iwe and French, she says her mother made so much money, she had a fleet of luxury cars. She also bought land, properties for her and her 10 children, and gold. She lived like a queen, she says. But the memories are tinged with bitterness. While thousands of women still work in the fabric trade, they earn a fraction of what they used to because of the economic shifts and struggles in Togo and the region. How can you buy clothes if you don't have food, she says. Then she says the market became saturated, driven by the success of the Nana Bens. Worse still, cheap Chinese imports have flooded the market, undercutting local traders. Most look like the Dutch wax fabrics, she says, and most customers can't tell the difference. Lomé is just one city along a rapidly growing 600-mile urban corridor between Nigeria and Ivory Coast. It will soon be home to more than 50 million people, but jobs and opportunities remain scarce.
A lot of these women learn how to trade from their mothers and the experiences of their mothers. And
Dr. Marius Kothor is an academic at Harvard University who was raised in Togo and has researched the history of the Nana Bens.
A lot of the women that I talked to, they were just kind of very sad about the fact that they're not trading in the volumes that they're used to trading.
She's interviewed generations of women traders across Togo and West Africa, where repeated economic shocks have made life much harder for small businesses. And as she says, it shows.
Just how dramatically people's fortunes can change because of the fact that these economies can be in a lot of ways very unstable.
She said for a time in Togo, the fabric trade was a rare chance at prosperity. But today the market is volatile and unrewarding. Francesca Ayaye grew up in awe of the success her mother achieved in the 1970s and 80s. And she joined the business, assuming she would carry it on. But now it's faltering. The prospect of achieving even a fraction of what her mother and the other Nana Bens did now feels out of reach. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lomé.
Time now for Word of the Week, our series about the origin and evolution of words. This week's word is cravat, a type of neckwear that's a more luxurious counterpart of the necktie. The cravat has a surprising history, beginning on the battlefields of 17th century Europe. Christina Kukulja has more.
The word cravat first appears in the French language in the early 1600s. It described military attire worn in the Thirty Years' War by Croatian mercenaries.
A Swedish king said that they are the new tribe of the devil.
That's historian Filip Hren from the Croatian Catholic University in Zagreb. He says the Croatian soldiers wore red neck scarves made of cotton or silk. Legend has it as a symbol of love from the women they left behind.
But it seems more likely that the scarf serves practical purposes such as protection from cold or from the smoke that could completely cover the battlefield.
Hren says the French armies noticed the Croats' fighting skills and their fashion sense. The French recruited many Croats into elite regiments, later named the Royal Cravats.
The scarves naturally took their names from Croats. It was tied in Croatian manner or in French à la cravate.
Hren says King Louis XIV introduced the cravat into French fashion, and it soon spread across Europe. The rise of 19th century bourgeois society brought the necktie. In many European languages, the translation still retains a link to the word for Croats, cravat in German, in Spanish corbata, and cravata in Italian.
Hello, how can I help you?
Many designs are on display today at the Kravatica Museum in Zagreb, which among its exhibits has a bulletproof tie from Thailand and another made from snakeskin. Co-founder Igor Mladinovic says the necktie was patented in the early 1920s by New York tailor Jesse Langsdorff.
He made a revolution when we talk about neckties. He designed it that way that it keeps its format and not be so soft as the pure silk scarf.
New patterns, colors, and fabrics define the decades since, from high fashion.
And the yellow cravat adds just that right touch of femininity.
To everyday menswear with the invention of cheap polyester fabric.
And at Oxford's 500 years old Bear Inn, you can get a free drink if the landlord likes your tie.
Over the decades, it's come to symbolize power and status and even conformity and oppression, echoing those early battlefield origins as it conquered modern fashion frontiers. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukulja in Zagreb, Croatia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is People Powered KAXE, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXE.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast. It is 519. You're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Slight chance of flurries tonight, lows in the teens below zero, northwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Partly sunny tomorrow, temps falling throughout the day. Blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Our lows tomorrow night near 30 below zero. And for Friday, mostly sunny daytime highs near 12 above, and lows on Friday night again, either side of 30 below zero. Looking ahead to Saturday, highs in the single digits below zero. More news is next on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump is 1 year into his second term at a moment when many scholars and historians and a growing number of voters say Trump has wielded power in ways that are shaking the foundations of American democracy. We wanted to hear how some of Trump's core supporters view his performance so far. So we sent NPR's Brian Mann on a road trip through conservative counties in the eastern U.S.
It is a messy, gray, snowy winter morning, and I'm heading first on this trip to Elkton, Maryland, a little town that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. The goal today, through what really is Trump country, is to talk to people. Ask how they feel about how this is going. The town's main street is mostly empty, but I find Anne Marie Hamilton working in an office, an arts nonprofit. She loves President Trump.
I want to be proud of him, and I was the first time he was in office.
Right away, I hear this deep personal loyalty, but also uncertainty. For Hamilton, the big question in Trump's second term is affordability, grocery prices, and her electric bill.
Prices are high enough that it stings like crazy. Like, you know, he ran his campaign and we're all like, yay. And yay, it didn't happen yet.
I ask if Hamilton sees any Democratic leaders offering better ideas, and she shakes her head. She tells me the Democratic brand is dead.
Yeah, broken. Nothing's resonating. 727
East. My next stop is Milford, a little town in Pike County, a place so conservative, some locals call it Trump County, Pennsylvania. Like my other stops, Milford is mostly rural and overwhelmingly white. There's a nasty snowstorm, so the downtown is empty, but I find a little diner where one of the waitresses, Tina Howell, tells me she thinks Trump is great, but she thinks he's focusing too much overseas.
He needs to start worrying about American first.
What about the question of affordability? Have you started to feel any real improvement there?
Nothing. I think it's getting tighter, actually, for people. Around here it is, in this town.
So, some real criticism. But Howell, too, says the Democratic Party isn't offering her choices. She can't name a single Democrat she likes or trusts. It's important to say my approach on this road trip isn't scientific. I'm spending time with random Trump voters in conservative towns. A poll released yesterday by YouGov and The Economist found one in four Republican voters think the country is on the wrong track under Trump. And I hear some of those doubts. But broadly, people tell me they're comfortable with Trump's use of federal power, including his controversial crackdown on immigrants. My final stop is Whitehall in Washington County, New York, where two-thirds of voters backed Trump in the last election. I meet Frank Juckett, a former Marine outside the American Legion Hall. He says Trump is an improvement over the Democrats and Joe Biden.
Better than what we had.
Okay, so report card. What's your grade?
A B+.
Pretty much so far, so good.
So far.
While we talk, Juckett echoes many criticisms of Trump, saying he too wants the president focused on domestic issues and the economy, not things like Greenland and Venezuela. Juckett tells me he sees Trump as a bully. At one point, he compares Trump's style to that of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
If they're really good and crooked, things get done. And if they're not, they get stepped on.
So the fact that he's kind of a rough character, that's a good thing?
Yes, I think so.
So here's the takeaway. After this first year, many people in Trump's base talk about him critically. I hear skepticism, questions, even some harsh judgments of Trump's character. Several people tell me they want less chaos, less drama. But I also hear deep distrust of the Democrats. And every Trump voter I talk to while in these conservative rural counties say they're willing to give him more time to make their lives better. Brian Mann, NPR News in Whitehall, New York.
Consumers are becoming more curious and more critical about a textile that is dominating fashion. We're talking about polyester. They're asking what impact the fabric has on human health and on the environment. NPR's Ayanna Archie has some answers.
Nafisa Attah is a self-proclaimed OG fast fashion shopper. She used to purchase clothes based on the best deals, but her clothes weren't holding up. She started reading fabric content labels and noticed just how prevalent polyester was in her clothes.
Once you know better, it's like your eyes are opened up to the fact that there are just so many poorly made clothes out there.
She's not imagining things. The rise of fast fashion has made polyester much more common. Here's Michael Palladino, a fashion industry veteran.
Fast fashion is a fire that can't be fed fast enough.
Henry Navarro Delgado is an associate professor at the Toronto Metropolitan University's School of Fashion. He says consumers want to be up on trends and pay as little as possible. Retailers want to meet the demand for those trends while keeping expenses low. Polyester is how both parties meet in the middle. It's a petroleum-based plastic that's often cheaper to make and buy.
This is a shared responsibility.
But Navarro Delgado says manufacturers are using polyester for items natural fibers would be better suited for. It may be used in summer clothes, even though it traps heat.
When you don't have access to a product that it is effectively designed for its purpose, then you don't use it.
So mounds of abandoned clothing have started showing up on coastlines in other countries. In Ghana, for example, people purchasing textiles to upcycle may dump poorly made polyester clothes into lagoons.
We don't see it here, but it shows up somewhere else.
Natural fibers can have drawbacks too. Palladino said it takes 700 gallons of water to get one cotton t-shirt from the farm to the store. But unlike natural fibers, polyester is not biodegradable. It's derived from fossil fuels, which emit greenhouse gases during production. Eventually, the fibers may break down into microplastics, but they don't go away. Instead, they often enter the water and air. Aaron Stubbins, a marine and environmental sciences professor at Northeastern University, says there's still a lot we don't know about the effects.
We're kind of at the point of understanding just where the plastics are.
There's also the matter of polyester's effects on human health. Some claims online suggest polyester can cause infertility in humans. Ryan Marino is a medical toxicologist who teaches at Case Western Reserve University. He says there's no proof of that. Polyester is often paired with forever chemicals, several of which have been linked to cancer. Marino says being exposed to polyester through clothing, air, or water could increase the risk of cancer.
Unless you are living near a landfill or dealing with large quantities of polyester, you are not going to encounter a dose of those compounds that is likely to cause significant health concerns.
To cut down on potential environmental effects, brands like Adidas and Patagonia say they're mostly using recycled polyester. All in all, there are ways to be a more savvy consumer. For example, Navarro Delgado says you can repair your clothes instead of buying new ones.
If one of your buttons fall off, you can replace it.
It's a way to make your clothes last, regardless of what they're made of. Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a few moments, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Low temperatures tonight in the teens, below zero, partly sunny tomorrow with temps falling throughout the day, blustery northwest winds, and lows tomorrow night near 30 below.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Investigators in St. Louis County recovered a body after a structure fire in Neason Township. Emergency personnel responded Monday afternoon to a pole building engulfed in flames about 15 miles north of Duluth. One person was unaccounted for and believed to be inside. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office stated that, quote, rescue efforts were not possible due to extreme fire conditions, but firefighters reportedly checked other locations. Several hours after the blaze was extinguished, investigators located the body of a 75-year-old Duluth man. He was identified as Neil Gordon Hendrickson. The fire appears to be accidental and was likely caused by Hendrickson's use of a grinder and blowtorch to work on a vehicle. The incident remains under investigation. In an ongoing escalation between the Trump administration and Minnesota, the U.S. Department of Justice has delivered subpoenas to Governor Tim Walz, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, St. Paul Mayor Kalee Herr, Attorney General Keith Ellison, and Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty. The Minnesota Reformer reports that the criminal investigation, which became public last week, appears to examine whether Walz's and Frey's public statements against the surge of federal immigration officers have led to interference in the federal agency's work. The estimated 3,000 agents involved in what the Department of Homeland Security calls Operation Metro Surge are often heavily armed and masked and outnumber any police force within the state of Minnesota. Opponents of the surge say agents are routinely denying detainees their rights to due process, namely access to counsel. DHS maintains that they are cleaning up sanctuary cities of illegal immigrants that commit violent crimes. Frey called the investigation a, quote, obvious attempt to intimidate. In a statement, Walz calls the investigation a, quote, partisan distraction. Ellison says the move is a, quote, weaponization of the justice system, coming instead of a serious investigation into the fatal shooting of Renee Good by ICE officer Jonathan Ross. Also on Tuesday, Ellison announced he will not make a run for governor, instead continuing to campaign for re-election as the state's top prosecutor. Ellison was first elected to the seat in 2018. Over his tenure, he says his office litigated suits that lowered the price of insulin, helped patients with medical debt, fought price gouging, and protected tenants and workers from exploitation. He says in a news release that, quote, Minnesota is in an unprecedented moment. The president of the United States is tearing apart families and terrorizing our communities. Ellison says he considered a bid for governor after Walz announced he would not seek a third term. Ellison initially made his re-election campaign announcement in October. Attorney and military veteran Ron Schutz announced he would run as a Republican also in October. More candidates are coming out of the Arrowhead to announce their 2026 campaigns. Republican Cal Warwas announced he would seek a second term in Minnesota's House of Representatives. The third-generation miner and union member was first elected in 2024. His 7B district serves a huge swath of the Iron Range and includes the communities of Chisholm, Boole, Eveleth, and Beewabik. Warwas says he is campaigning to strengthen mining and to make energy more affordable. Aaron Kania is seeking the DFL endorsement to run for the House 3A seat. This seat, currently held by Republican Roger Scraba, represents far northern communities from International Falls to the Grand Portage Reservation. Kania, a former law enforcement officer, wildland firefighter, and forester, says the largest House district in Minnesota is one of the most complex. He is campaigning on economic growth and lowering the cost of living. The U.S. Forest Service says they will maintain current requirements for all food, food containers, garbage, and scented items to be securely stored to help prevent human-bear interactions in the Boundary Water Canoe Area Wilderness. The closure order issued Thursday maintains that these attractants must be suspended at least 12 feet above the ground and at least 6 feet away from the trunk of a tree. Items may also be stored in an interagency Grizzly Bear Committee certified bear-resistant container. These restrictions apply after bears emerge from hibernation between April 1st and November 30th. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump arrived at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland today. His insistent push for the U.S. to own Greenland has captured the world's attention. And he made news at this forum, ruling out, at least for now, the use of military force.
We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that. Okay? Now everyone's saying, oh, good. That's probably the biggest statement I made, because people thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force.
Trump also ended up backing down from an earlier threat of higher tariffs on eight European countries. We're joined now by NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who's been monitoring Trump's remarks from Washington. Hi, Tam.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, let's start with Greenland. It's a territory of Denmark, which is, of course, a member of NATO. Denmark's a U.S. ally. How did Trump today re-explain his desire for the U.S. to take over Greenland?
Well, he said it is in the Western Hemisphere and is strategically important for U.S. national security. He insisted the U.S. is the only country with the strength to defend it, develop it, and improve it. He called for immediate negotiations to discuss U.S. acquisition.
And all we're asking for is to get Greenland, including right title and ownership, because you need the ownership to defend it. You can't defend it on a lease.
He called this a very small ask, but in fact, it has caused a major rift with U.S. allies in Europe. And this would be a good time to note that NATO has a mutual defense agreement. And the only time it has been invoked was after 9/11, when European countries helped the United States.
That's right. And at this point, Tam, is it fair to say that the U.S. commitment to NATO has been totally thrown into question by President Trump's Greenland quest?
Yeah, Trump has long played coy with his commitment to NATO and has often been quite critical of other countries in the alliance. And now with Greenland at center stage, leaders of longtime U.S. allies are very openly questioning the reliability of the United States. Meanwhile, in this Davos speech, Trump called both Denmark and Canada ungrateful and questioned the value of the alliance to the U.S.
I don't know that they'd be there for us. They're not there for us on Iceland, that I can tell you. I mean, our stock market took the first dip yesterday because of Iceland. So Iceland's already cost us a lot of money.
So there are two notable things about that clip. The president repeatedly said Iceland when he meant to say Greenland, which the press secretary then denied ever happened. And Trump also showed his hand a bit. The markets have not reacted well to his Greenland escalation, and he is very sensitive to the markets. In fact, stocks rose today on news that President Trump was ruling out the use of military force.
I'm glad you clarified there, Tam, because I was confused by his mention of Iceland. Okay, we also mentioned that Trump backed down from from an earlier threat of higher tariffs. I saw that Trump wrote in a social media post that he had a framework for some sort of future deal on Greenland. Do we know what that framework looks like and how it came about?
Yeah, the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, has been something of a Trump whisperer in this second term, largely by piling on praise. And the two met just hours after Trump's speech. And with cameras rolling, Rutte told Trump it pained him to think that the president doubted NATO's commitment to the U.S. Trump now says they have a concept of a deal, though there was no mention of the U.S. actually owning Greenland, as he had been demanding. He dodged questions about that, simply saying it would be an infinite deal.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Thank you so much, Tam.
You're welcome.
Next up, some good news about heart disease. Deaths caused by strokes and other heart conditions are on the decline. That's according to a new study from the American Heart Association. So what will it take to keep the momentum going? NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
About every 34 seconds, someone somewhere in the U.S. dies from heart disease, which remains the leading cause of death for both men and women. So the news of a decline is striking. Here's cardiologist Dr. Stacy Rosen of the American Heart Association.
The good news is encouraging to see that deaths from heart disease and stroke are down. And I think that's very good and certainly puts us in the right direction.
Rosen says emerging from the long shadow of the pandemic helps explain the dip, which amounts to about 25,000 fewer deaths in 2023 compared to the year before.
I think the last 5 years, as health overall was impacted by the COVID pandemic, was something of an anomaly.
Now the challenge is to maintain the positive momentum, which Rosen says will require a preventive strategy where the healthcare system and each person as an individual focus more on the conditions that set the stage for heart disease. For starters, everyone should know whether they have high blood pressure, also known as hypertension.
When you look at the United States statistics, there's actually almost 50% of Americans have the diagnosis of hypertension. And it is truly, aside from quitting tobacco, the most modifiable risk that we have.
Many people don't realize they have high blood pressure because it doesn't bring any specific symptoms. That's why checkups are important. And the good news is that treating high blood pressure with medicine and lifestyle changes can literally prevent heart disease, explains Sadia Khan of Northwestern University. She's part of the team behind the new report.
Improving high blood pressure with medicine has never been easier. There are so many inexpensive therapies available, and getting blood pressure under control can add years to life as well as prevent heart disease, stroke, and dementia.
Two additional drivers of heart disease are obesity and diabetes, which can also be managed with a combination of medicines and changes in lifestyle habits, including eating better and moving more. Dr. Khan says to make progress, community-level policy changes could help.
Having environments that promote activity can help us make healthier choices. And so thinking about policies on a local level that can create more green spaces for having safe places to exercise.
And when it comes to individual changes, Dr. Stacy Rosen says it can be best to start with small, bite-sized goals.
So rather than saying, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to exercise more, say I'm going to take the stairs twice a day, every day. I'm going to not have a bread basket if I go out for a meal.
Celebrating small wins is a nice on-ramp to healthier habits, which can help fend off heart disease. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The Artemis 2 mission is getting closer and closer.
And now, NASA says, is your chance to orbit the moon with the astronauts.
Well, kind of. Your name can, anyway.
Along with the four astronauts aboard the Orion spacecraft, there's going to be an SD card.
And your name could be on it.
The mission may launch in early February. That all depends on whether the vehicle and the crew are ready.
And the weather, you know, the forecast.
It's pretty easy to submit your name at NASA.gov.
Or the name of that ex you never, ever want to see again.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. San Francisco is moving forward with plans to dismantle an iconic and controversial fountain. The fountain has sat on the city's waterfront for more than 50 years. The city's skateboarding community says that if the fountain goes, so will an important piece of sports history. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Katie DeBenedetti reports.
On a recent afternoon, the vast brick Embarcadero Plaza that's been home to the Valancourt Fountain was quiet. Commuters bustled past, and a few workers sat on nearby metal benches, but most ignored the 700-ton tangle of blocky concrete tubes built by Canadian sculptor Armand Valancourt in 1971. That's pretty typical these days, but Bay Area pro skater Carl Watson says in the 90s, it sounded more like this. That's the sound of a skater launching over a set of stairs at the plaza in 1991. Watson says at that time, people came from across the Bay Area and way beyond to take part in developing a new style of the sport.
It was truly the mecca of skateboarding.
He says the Embarcadero Plaza's architectural elements, like one concrete concave wall they called the Wave, helped create new skate moves.
Modern day street skating was actually developed here at the Embarcadero.
While the skaters didn't usually skate the fountain itself, it towered over the plaza. Skater Jacob Rosenberg called it the anchor.
It was the landmark of this destination skate spot.
Watson and Rosenberg are part of a group of skaters that's been advocating to save the fountain. It's set to be removed as the city makes way for a new waterfront park on the Embarcadero. That could happen as soon as March, after their appeal to slow the process failed at San Francisco's Board of Supervisors last week. City officials say the fountain has to go because of major structural deterioration and sky-high restoration costs. Here's Tamara Apperton with the Recreation and Parks Department.
There is a real risk of one of its arms collapsing. It has lead and asbestos in it, and the risks are really unpredictable.
While the fountain is iconic to skaters and modern architecture fans, not all San Franciscans feel a similar connection. Terry Krause has lived in an apartment a few blocks away for more than 20 years. At a city meeting on the matter in November, she supported removing the fountain so the city's revamp can go forward. She says it'll bring new businesses and foot traffic to her area.
This is a golden opportunity to revitalize my neighborhood.
Valancourt's brutalist style has never been universally beloved. When it debuted, critics compared the fountain to the droppings of a robot dog and dynamited debris. Here's Margaret Crawford, Professor Emerita of Architecture at UC Berkeley.
The aesthetic of a kind of fragmentation, collision, etc., a lot of people don't like that.
Still, Rosenberg says removing it feels like losing the last piece of skate history at the spot.
The plaza has changed over the years from that original era, but I think that the loss of the fountain really expresses, you know, a sense of finality.
The city plans to move the fountain's parts into storage for a few years. It says what happens after that is still up in the air. For NPR News, I'm Katie DeBenedetti in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. You're listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear the set list, some live music you can check out this weekend. 7 o'clock, Brandon Lentz, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. 10 o'clock, more great music on Headwaters with Kari Headland. Support for KAXE comes from the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing amenities like their large parking lot suitable for trailers and boats and offering fresh baked breakfast items each day. Additional information at imhoteltimberlake.com. There is an extreme cold watch going in effect tomorrow until noon on Sunday for most of the region. The dangerously cold wind chills as low as 50 below could cause frostbite on exposed skin in as little as 5 minutes. So do be careful. Tonight, chance of flurries, lows in the teens below, west to northwest winds 10 to 20. Partly sunny tomorrow with temperatures falling throughout the day to around 20 below by 5 p.m. and then overnight lows near 30 below. Blustery northwest winds tomorrow up to 25 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny, daytime highs near 12 below and lows on Friday night around 30 below once again. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Lead for Inclusion invites community members age 14 and up to a book club discussion of When Stars Are Scattered. That is happening Wednesday, March 4th, but you can email info@leadforinclusion.org to sign up for this and to get a free copy of the book. And Crossing Arts Alliance has a class at the Pine River Public Library this Monday, 4 o'clock. Learn how to sketch the winter landscape using pastels and charcoal. Register online at crossingarts.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Crux is a term that rock climbers know well. It's the most challenging section of a route, the place where, quote, everything inside yourself told you to wait, to stall, to cling to safety, and yet where if you wanted to live, you had to take the risk. That is how author Gabriel Tallent describes it in his new novel called Crux. It's his first since his debut, My Absolute Darling, made its own ascent on bestsellers list back in 2017. Tallent is a climber himself and embraces that fear that accompanies the exhilaration.
I love that climbing can have this inch-by-inch terror, and it just takes you to spectacular settings that you would never reach in your ordinary life with just wild people. So you're on the journey with someone else, and it's cooperative. You're working together, which is something that I have always loved about the sport. It tends to open people up a little bit. Like, I have had some of my wildest and most confessional moments, like sitting on ledges with friends.
Tallent's new novel begins with one such moment, high on a ledge in California, between 17-year-old best friends Tama and Dan.
Dan is a little bit like a disaffected golden child. He's tall, handsome, good at school, well-liked by his teachers, and it's believed that he's going to go on to have a promising future at college, but it's not something that he wants. He's sort of living through the onset of major mental illness or depression, and every night he goes out and climbs with his best friend Tama, who is this sort of mouthy burnout. She's a little bit provocative. She's equally smart, but in ways that don't lend to success at school, so she's not well liked by her teachers and peers, but they're really bonded and they go climbing together, and that's the future that he wants. And Tama herself is a little bit more, her family is a little bit more working class. There's no chance at college for her. If she's not able to make climbing work as a vocation and a future, she doesn't really see anything for herself other than slowly becoming her mother, like a sort of a burned out waitress at diners, which is not a future that inspires her. So she's filled with sort of desperate urgency to escape that.
I couldn't help thinking about my own friendships at that stage of life when you're like on the cusp of adulthood and trying to figure out who you are and who you want to be. What was interesting to you to explore about that stage of transition that Dan and Tama find themselves in?
The dream of climbing is for them knit together with their friendship, mm-hmm. because they climb together. But friendship is itself not a relationship that I think is highly valued in the culture or that we have a lot of cultural narratives about. So they don't necessarily have a model for striking out together as friends. And that makes it seem in some ways impossible or risky. So I'm interested in that, in the idea of betting a lot on a friendship, believing in a friendship when the culture doesn't believe in it. How do you make the decisions then?
Another thing that comes up as I think about Dan and Tama's shared love of climbing is this element of risk inherent in this passion that they share. Throughout the book, they attempt these ambitious climbs. They fail. They get hurt just to keep doing this thing that they love. They're literally putting their bodies on the line. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Sometimes we think about risk as if it's something we take on or don't take on, mm-hmm. as if Dan and Tama's life is somehow riskless if they never go climbing. But that's not true. Like, they are seeing people around them who, by not taking risks day after day, end up hedged into lives they don't love. So there is this way that just by avoiding risk, you can end up losing everything in just the same way. To, like, chase that sense of aliveness and meaning, sometimes you have to embrace the risk. And that's scary and also important. But never doing that doesn't keep you safe.
I read somewhere else, Gabriel, that it took you somewhere around 8 years to get your debut novel, My Absolute Darling, into a form where you felt it was publishable. What about this book? When did you start writing it?
Yeah. How long? It took me 8 years with this one as well. I mean, I started this book in 2015, but that's misleading, because what I did is I wrote novel after novel that didn't work. Mm. And then when our first son, Hayden, was born, it was the depths of the pandemic. And I had this experience of holding him after he was born and thinking a lot about my life and his life and what I would tell him would matter. And thinking about it, I found that I didn't really believe it was climbing that mattered. And I had written a book about climbing at the highest echelons of the sport, about climbing at important climbs, you know, climbs of substance, famous climbs in some of the most beautiful destinations in the world. And as I was holding this baby, it's like, that's not what you love about a person, that they succeed or that they climb at the highest levels. I felt it lay somewhere else. And so I threw those books away. I really started this book then. And it came together kind of quickly after that, like after I had the heart of it. And I realized it wasn't about climbing at the cutting edge. It was something else. It was the story of friendship and chasing meaning in your life and pursuing that.
The other thing that I found really interesting, and I'm going to try to ask this without spoiling your beautiful book for people, is that later in the book, we see Tama thrust into this family conflict where she ends up having to step in and step up and care for her sister's children as her sister's trying to juggle work and a parenting crisis. And I think it shows this sort of different side to Tama rather than sort of the brash and brusque and say anything, do anything person that you meet in the early pages of the book. What did you hope to show about Tama as a caretaker versus the Tama that you see when she's with Dan and when she's doing these climbs?
I mean, for one thing, this just happens in people's lives. Like, in my life, it seems like you're pursuing a dream and then a comet comes out of nowhere and changes your entire life. And so I think with writing, something I am trying to do is subject the protagonist to so much pressure that they are destroyed, that they come apart, so that we can see their guts. We can see who they are. We can see who they are in their worst moments. So a lot of times what you're trying to do is you're trying to make a character's worst fears come true. Ask of them the thing that they are worst at. You ask the same thing of Tama, right? You ask her to be in this role of caregiver that she's terrified of because she doesn't have a good model for it. And because it's going to take away from her climbing. So yeah, I guess you're trying to ruin a character so that we can see how they muster, how they survive, what they do in the darkest nights of their lives. Because that's something that readers are going through. Readers themselves are sometimes going through hard things. So you want to show, like, if you want to put hope and joy and aliveness in a book, you have to take your characters to dark places, because real people are searching for hope and aliveness and joy from dark places.
We've been speaking with Gabriel Tallent. His new novel is Crux. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University of Maryland Libraries, home to the NPR Archives, dedicated to preserving the history of public broadcasting and serving researchers around the world. More at lib.umd.edu. From Luminescence Foundation, Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From EBSCO, dedicated to empowering medical affairs teams with peer-reviewed research, AI-powered summaries, and tools for literature reviews. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is a minute before 6 o'clock. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-123. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Slight chance of flurries tonight, lows 14 to 19 below, winds from the west northwest up to 20 miles per hour. Partly sunny tomorrow, temps falling throughout the day with blustery northwest winds.